Hello and welcome to We're All Gonna Die and Other Fun Facts, a semi-regular, occasionally amusing, and rarely funny series of conversations on a random topic. This episode is entitled Demoitis. And it's about, well, it sounds like a disease, but really it's about knowing when something is finally finished, and it's something that you've created that's finally finished. And our guest for this episode is someone who has not only created the theme music for this fine podcast, but who has fought, who's waged the war against demoitis for years. Yes, Mr. Brett Zorich.
Hello.
Yes, hello.
Thank you,
and welcome to the podcast that you get mentioned in every episode,
well,
and now you're on it. And I think this is the first time. It only took 30-some-odd episodes. It's just us.
It is. Yeah. And I'm sober.
Yeah. So this is... We are in uncharted territory,
mm-hmm,
folks.
Mm-hmm,
we
mm-hmm.
are...
This
so
is huge.
I guess maybe the first thing is, since you were the person who introduced this concept to me,
mm-hmm,
what is demoitis?
So demoitis, the way I mean it, first applies specifically to music. It stands for demonstration recording, and so just like it sounds, the idea is when you don't have the full idea fleshed out, you just have kind of the highlights of an idea. Sometimes it helps it to solidify if you put it on tape first before you really think too much about it, thereby giving a demonstration of what it would sound like. And then when you and I started talking about it, we realized you could kind of apply that to almost any medium, right?
Yeah.
I mean, not just music, but so in that context, then it becomes just the kind of colloquial way of saying that you're trying to flesh out an idea by using like a rough draft, right?
Yeah.
Well, it's supposed to be rough in theory.
Yeah.
The idea being, at least initially, you're not supposed to use it as the final product. Like by definition, it's only to serve other means like later on down the road, right?
Yeah.
But that doesn't always happen, I think. That's kind of what we talk
about. Yeah, and I think, too, I mean, part of this idea, too, is I guess there's a couple different ways of making demos, right? I mean, there is...
You mean musically specifically?
Musically specifically,
yeah.
There's
a ton of different ways, yeah.
So I was thinking about one way is, of course, you know, I'm thinking the 4-track or the garage band or whatever. They just play it and record it, and it's like, okay, this is what the song sounds like. Please, Mr. Record Company, hire us a producer and an expensive studio, and we'll mm-hmm. make it sound awesome. But this is what the song sounds like.
Yeah.
Now, having known you and your workings with Team Triggers for a while now, and the solo record that you're working on, it seems like the demo is almost part of the composition process. Which is a completely different monster, right?
Yeah, you're exactly right. And it became that way because of through conversations like this, because you really start to... You're right. The old model is you put down the best that you can do and you kind of wait for people who supposedly know more than you to go, I hear something in this that's going to make you kids, you know, stars or whatever.
Which is probably a world that doesn't exist anymore,
right,
if you're not
exactly.
Justin Bieber. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. And, you know, one could argue the point that, and I think that's what we're talking about, there is some instances in which that's appropriate, where you get a certain talented ear, certain talented producer, someone who really knows, has vision, and maybe the initial artist or what have you, composer doesn't. But you're right, 9 times out of 10, I mean, there's so many great records now, so many great solo people. You know, Jack White was one of the first people that I know of that kind of just didn't give a shit. That just, when I say first, I mean, there's been a lot of artists, don't get me wrong, that have kind of done their own thing. But Jack White's the first one that I know of that's in today's, that's still making, like, quote, hit records, but is still somehow considered indie.
Yeah.
And that's because he more or less has figured out a model that works for him, which is I'll record it myself, I'll own all the publishing, and I'll put my own money into it, so whatever, $25,000 for a record, which for him is nothing, and then he makes all that money back. So to him, there really probably isn't, I mean, I won't speak for the guy, but I would imagine that he's probably, a lot of his demos, quote demos, end up being the record, right? Yeah. I mean, so yeah, that, I mean, I think that's the, that is the second way of doing it, is kind of, like you said, it becomes part of the song. I mean, how many times have I come to you and said, oh, I have this demo of something and played it for you, and then it turns out, you know, it really, sometimes I'm really actually going around trying to recapture the initial demo. Like when you go to record it later, you're going, yeah, but listen to how great my energy is in this vocal or whatever. And it's like, I got to try to recapture that. And it's like, dude, you were in your living room in your underwear, like hungover, you know, like it wasn't that pretty at the time,
yeah.
You know.
I mean, the one listenable Bruce Springsteen album,
mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
and everything else is like ridiculous and awful, and he's a cartoon man.
Yeah, exactly.
But
strap
like,
your legs to my engine. Yeah,
yeah.
Whatever that. Copyright.
Yeah.
But no. Was that either you or Adam? One of you told me that, like, it was basically, if it were you, you can jump in here. He basically had it on, like, a cassette tape and, like, carried it around in his pocket in his jeans for, like, months at a time. Like, the actual final record. He just had one copy on a cassette tape.
Wasn't me, but it might have been a mutual friend of ours.
Okay.
Or that other mutual
friend.
But you think, and he recorded, I know from that mutual friend, he recorded the Born in the USA, ridiculous, bombastic,
mm-hmm.
80s Pepsi commercial rock, mm-hmm. you know, that was in the same way. It's just certain songs became, and other songs became this, you know, here's a guy just trying to, you know, belt something out in his bedroom. And I think it was recorded on a boombox. It wasn't even like a four track.
Yeah. Yeah, and see, that's bizarre to me because, so Emmett Rhodes is the artist my dad turned me on to. I think it was like 1970 or something. I forget the year. For those of you with Wikipedia, he put out this song.
Go to the internet.com/foreskin.
He put out this record, Emmett Rhodes. He made it. He was like 17 when he recorded it. Made it in his parents' garage and put it out as is, and it's perfect. Like, from beginning to end, it's a perfect record. But he'd get away with that because he knew how to record, played the drums, played the guitar, played the bass, played the piano, sang all the parts. What I don't understand about Springsteen is, like, he's just limited in what he physically can do. Like, he can't play the drums that I know of.
Yeah.
He can't really play any other instrument. I mean, he barely holds on to the guitar. So I could see him... Like, I don't understand how he can make a record like Born in the USA, or like, how he could even make a demo of that. I mean, I haven't heard it. Have you heard any of it? Is there, like, drums and stuff on it?
No, there's not. Though, again, that mutual friend, I believe those recordings now exist, and you can go find them probably on mm-hmm. theinternet.com.
Mm-hmm.
But for the most part, yeah, it's just him with an idea, and hey, here's some chords, and here's some words.
So, like,
and
McCartney...
And then we'll bring it to... the rest of the people and the big money producer and again, make it into a Pepsi commercial.
Yeah, and McCartney, you know, I'm a huge fan of, like, he could do everything, so he made whole records like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't understand how you could, I mean, really, if you're pretty limited in what you can physically do, mm-hmm. you either have to decide, okay, I'm going to Jeff Buckley this and just be a guy with an acoustic guitar, or... you have to get some other members to help you execute. And when you do that, you're going to run the risk of it turning into like a bombastic. Now, that could have been his idea, so this maybe isn't the right example. But I mean,
Elliott Smith, Roman Candle.
There you go.
It's a great, mm-hmm. great record that was four-track in a basement. And I think Kiwi Lime, or is it Kiwi 20, Mad MD 2020, has, I think that's the one that has drums on it because there's not a vocal track.
Right, right.
Because you had to pick. Guitar, yeah. Bass. Mm-hmm. You know, like, I think two guitars, bass, drums. And, oh, we can have room for drums now.
Right.
And this one. This one will have drums because... or there's something that's added to that because there's no vocal track.
Am I mistaken that Beck did... Originally, he did, like, Mellow Gold before Odelay because he was just doing him in an acoustic guitar, and then they didn't release it till later.
Yeah.
But I think same there's, idea. Now, I mean, that guy can't do anything, but...
Yeah. Or, I mean, you know, in a different concept, I mean, one of my favorite records to come out last year was the Fugazi 88 demos.
Oh, okay.
That
I don't know anything about this.
They finally released last year the 88 demos when they first got together as a band. Which you think, and also, you know, at the time, Discord was already up and running, so it's not like they needed to shop around.
Right.
I guess there was a version that was released on cassette that was just sort of like, hey, we're going to play some shows, and we need gas money. Mm-hmm. And so they made a quick recording of songs that sometimes didn't show up till like three albums later or whatever. And it finally came out, and they're great. It's wonderful,
really?
And alive and vibrant. And again, it's a full band recording something, but it's like, we got to get this down quick. Of course, the whole Discord thing is you get $6,000 to make a record, and that's it.
Yeah. Which is kind of nice. But yeah. But I guess that's part of the question is, do those things inherently, you know, a lot of people, and this is probably for some other discussion, but, you know, sometimes being limited in what choices you can make ends up making a stronger product, at least, even from an artistic standpoint, you have more integrity, more structure, because you're limited in what you can do. So you wonder, like, does something like Demoitis, is it a, you know, are those recordings better because of that, or are they better in spite of it? I mean, that's a tough thing, right?
That's a tough thing, and I think that might be like a case-by-case basis thing, a matter of like ears, or, I mean, I think about even another person, Frank Black, Francis, Charles Thompson, whatever, made that Cult of Ray record, and it was the most money he had ever had to make a record. He released it on American, and that album is unlistenable. There's like one song on there that has a redeeming quality. And
so that's a great question. When you say made money, do you know if it's because he sold the most?
Oh, I'm sorry, not made money, had money.
I might have misquoted
it. It was the largest, I said it wrong. The largest recording budget he had in his entire career, Pixies records.
But it wasn't popular.
It wasn't popular, and the record's actually unlistenable.
Right.
And immediately after, all the Frank Black and the Catholics albums, which I think are brilliant, and in some ways, I think I might... This is heresy. This is hipster heresy.
Here we go.
I might, if I were to like listen to his music, I might put one of those on more than I would even Doolittle.
Sure. No, I hear that, yeah.
They were all recorded live to a two-track.
Yeah.
He actually created a mobile unit that was in the trailer that was being towed by the van. It would just do it at soundcheck to two mics.
Let's think of examples then while we're in this exercise. So if you're thinking about case by case, you know, we come from totally different musical things that we...
Venn diagram has a lot of overlap.
That is true.
And I don't think you've ever been really wrong for me. Like, you say, hey, check this out.
I've never gone,
that sucks. You know what I mean? But,
oh, thank you.
You know, books and movies.
We'll try to
about that like Simon's fighting fish. But yeah, okay. So, but musically, there's a big Venn diagram lap over.
So I tend to, when I come up with musical examples, I tend to use the same several people for a couple reasons. Some of which because I'm familiar with them and love them, but also because they're so famous that it's sometimes hard when you're having a discussion to, like, you know, reference obscure people that some folks may have never heard, and they're out of the talk, really. They have no point of reference. So
Well, you know, there's that Electric Eels demo.
Right, exactly.
from 73, when they were in Columbus, when they left Cleveland. They were in Columbus for about 8 months.
Have you ever heard of the Hot and Top Testicles record?
And so... I always come back to McCartney, but for several reasons, some of them because I'm just a genuine admirer and fan, but also the most famous pop musician alive, probably, one of the most, certainly career spanning. So he's just a good example to have because everybody's heard of him. So he's a good... What I'm wondering is, does it depend on the artist if they can... If they have to be on one side of that line of, look, you have to let them, you know, have their way on their terms, you know, and not have any, and just give them $1,000 or $5,000 to make some genius with a capital G thing.
Yeah.
Or, you know, do they have to have guidance from other music collaboration?
Collaboration. I think some people are that way. Right. I think some people, I mean, I think Ben Folds
yeah.
is somebody who has the, what I call, you know, M. Night Shyamalan syndrome.
Right.
Where it sort of, somebody needs somebody to say, no, that's mm-hmm. not a good idea, you know. I think right. there's some folks that, yeah, have it and can just do it and do whatever the hell they want and doesn't need any help.
Before you go any further, I'll come back to McCartney when you said M. Night Shyamalan. Mm-hmm. So those are both great examples. I'm talking about people who had insanely big, a lot of enormous success their first time out. Right, yeah. The first thing they ever touched that was more or less popular, well, in the popular realm. I'm yeah. sure he made some art films or something, I don't know.
Yeah.
But certainly in the case of McCartney, the first time at bat, he hit a grand slam, and then yeah. he kept hitting them.
Yeah.
So then at a certain point, you have your own gravity, your own kind of, you become like a star in the capital sense of the word, where the rest of the world starts kind of maneuvering around you.
Yeah.
Right? And when that happens, your sense of perspective becomes mm-hmm. skewed. You can imagine your sense of the amount of weight that you put on other people's opinions yeah. probably, you would imagine, becomes lighter and lighter because you think to yourself, well, I've been nailing it. Now, not for everyone. I'm just saying yeah. for these two examples, you could imagine them being like, they did it their own way. They mm-hmm. did it on their terms. And in the case of Paul, it's a little different because he did have, obviously, you know, he did have John Lennon in his band. That yeah, helps.
But, yeah, and I think that's extremely different because you do have some pushback, probably,
mm-hmm.
or some sense of, like, having an immediate audience to
right.
keep you honest. Because, yeah, John Lennon's the other person,
right.
the other primary songwriter for that band, right. and those other two guys weren't slouches either.
They weren't. But I guess the point I was coming to is once he went solo.
If we
think of that as like the Beatles as his hitting the home runs part of that,
yeah.
that sloppy analogy,
yeah.
admittedly. Once his first solo records, especially at the time, even records that are considered by a lot of people, including me, to be amazing, like Ram and his first solo record, were just torn to shreds by critics because it wasn't, you know, you went from Abbey Road to McCartney. Well, and the thing is, he, you know, they said, where, you know, basically, where's your filter? Like, you know, when you have Lennon there and Harrison and George Martin and
yeah.
blah, you've got all these filters of people going. Yeah. It's so, A, it's partly that. B, he had someone to compete against, right? He had a sparring partner. If
yeah.
Lennon came in or Harrison towards the end there with a great song and said, here's what I did today, what'd you do?
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to
yeah.
be like, oh, I kind of have this, like, masturbatory middling song about my
yeah.
wife that no one cares about. You really are like, well, damn, I gotta step up my game,
yeah.
you know. And I think
yeah. and
he had neither of those, you know.
Yeah. Well, and I think too, I mean, the other part about that, there's a whole other dimension to this, and I think that genius is a collective thing. I think as much as sometimes we like to ascribe, oh, the lone person out there, I can say in my own life, yeah, there you go, Confederacy of Dunces. There are some people who, yeah, it can go off. But I think a lot of times it's so amazing to have contemporaries, even if it's just having people around. I mean, being a full-fledged member of an English department, just that has made me better, as opposed to when I was an adjunct and I didn't know anybody I worked with, and I only interacted with...
So let's define demo-itis then, because we kind of didn't... I just defined demo, sorry. I should have gone further. We started off... Okay, so to go back to your point, though. So demo-itis, this is a term that I don't know where it came up with. Where it's
18
like
minutes
18
later.
Minutes in, sorry. Well, because it had something relevant to... Okay,
yeah.
So I don't know who came up with it. So, again, you could probably Google it. I never have. But the person who told it to me was the producer on the Trigger's first record, named John Hyler, and he called it demo-itis because it was kind of a disease analogy where you had this demo, you make it this like precious thing. You add your little, because you're by yourself in your own little like lab, you know. And so, oh, I'm gonna put this harmony here, and oh, I got it just the way I want it. Oh, this little tambourine hit and this little drum fill, and so then when you go to make the record, any idea that someone else has, or even if you have, that's not that, that's not the thing that's already there, you immediately dismiss as being,
yeah.
And even not just dismiss, even if you're open minded to it, at least in the case of music, for me, you're part of the pleasure of music is when your ear can anticipate something and then it hits it. That's why sometimes it takes you a couple listens before you're like, or at least for me, before I'm like, oh wow, this makes total sense.
Yeah.
And part of the fun of,
damn it.
8-1-4-4-7-2.
I will. All right.
Part of the fun with music is once your ear anticipates something, you know, if there's like a, there's those little moments, certain harmonies or what are vocal hooks, half the fun is you're like, oh, wait till you get to this part. Wait, listen to this. Ah, you know, that like payoff. And so sometimes when you have a demo and you're so used to that payoff, anyone that would have come in and go, yeah, that's cool, but instead of that, what if we did this? And if when you listen to it, because it doesn't immediately have that payoff that you're used to, you're like, yeah, I like it the other way. Or at least that's how I am. And he used it to describe, hey, you guys have demoitis here. His point being, objectively, this is a better way to do it.
Yeah.
And you guys don't see it, or me, and if he's talking to me, you don't see it because you're so wrapped up in you have demoitis. So that is the definition of demoitis, right?
Which is weird, because I interpreted the concept slightly differently.
Oh, okay.
And thinking about, I think the way it's not that differently. I guess I describe it differently, but I think it's the same concept for me. And I think I come into this with like writing, especially, as do the people I teach writing to. There's this real issue with working on something and feeling like it's done, you know, and just saying, okay, well, I worked in this for how many hours? And for me, sometimes I get bored with stuff before it's done, and so it's done, you know, and just thinking like it works so hard and it becomes sort of set
so
in the
person's
head.
Do you have examples in your head, at least, that you don't have to share them, but where you thought something was done and then you got feedback on it and that caused you to realize it wasn't done? And then,
oh, absolutely.
And then in retrospect, you realized they were right?
Absolutely. Huh. Yeah, I mean, I...
That's kind of like what I meant.
Yeah, and it's weird. I have
to say to someone, "Hey, you should change this." Obviously, implies that it's not done, right?
Yeah.
Because but still, yeah, I see what you're saying.
Yeah, I mean, I have, I have one friend. Like a lot of times, I show people my poetry and stuff, and they're like, "Oh, that's great, that's great." I have one friend, former colleague, who will say, "How about this, this, and this?" And it just, and I like the support.
Do you think he does it to just as an exercise, or like in other words, could you present, not to speak for him, but could you present to him something that he would ever come back to you and go, this is perfect? Or do you think he immediately gets you to think three or whatever, these things, just as an exercise?
I think that person, that individual who's actually a former, I should say it's Mike Begnall, former former guest.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Just writes on another level. I mean, I think he is one of those people who like, he just does things that I'll never be able to do with words. You know, I can kind of put my little thing together and it'll be fine. He does shit that, like, forget
different
it. Like,
levels.
He just works on a different level.
So it's probably not a concept thing for him. It's just
Concept. Yeah. He's just that good.
Okay,
right?
Fair enough.
Just that good. And he's lucky enough that he's, you know, he can just be honest with me and go, well, yes, but blah, 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 blah. And maybe you should have done this. And if I mean, as someone who's just worked really hard at his craft and, so for me, yeah. So I have these examples of something where I think it's done and it gets set in my head. And I think without him or without a little bit of feedback or whatever, I have a very hard time reimagining at any point, unless I let something sit for like 2 or 3 years.
Right.
And I have stuff like that too, where I just so check out of the mindset I was in when I made it.
You're like the anti-George Lucas, who just will not let it go. He's just like, well, it's been 35 years, but it's just not done yet. And you're like, oh, dude, leave it alone. It's funny you mention the whole leave it sit for 2 or 3 years or whatever you said, because that's honestly, when you said demos becoming part of the process, so that's my process right now. And it's not perfect, obviously, but right now, especially with the solo stuff that I'm doing, I try to get it something recorded when it's the smallest germ of an idea, and then I don't touch it, I don't listen to it, I don't think about it, and I try to wait until I completely forget about it, and then when I hear it, I try to be let it hit me as honestly as possible.
Mm-hmm.
To try to see if something comes to me right away and I'm like, oh, that's just way too damn slow. That's just too slow. You know, yeah. or like, oh, that's just not catchy. I don't even know yeah. what I was thinking or whatever. Or, you know, and I typically don't always, sometimes I write lyrics really quickly for that reason, because I find lyrically, I really dwell on stuff. And like, that's just a death sentence to just yeah. sit there and pick apart your own lyrics. It's just, it's horrible artistically. It's horrible emotionally. It's, yes. it's just horrible. It's horrible. No good can come from it. So one of the things I try to do is write lyrics really quickly if I can and get them down and then not think about them and yeah. just see how they hit me later.
Yeah.
Because you're right, man. Otherwise, you know, especially, you know, since I'm usually doing most of the instruments myself on these, I don't really have, you know, I do have, in case of Triggers, I have amazing filters because, you know, Joe and Woody and Adam are all just, they can also play every instrument and also and better than I and can also write, and they also have their own projects on their own.
Yeah.
So it's not like anyone's sitting around waiting for me to come to them going, here, boys, listen to what, which is yeah. helpful, right? Because they yeah. can go like, don't like that. That's crappy. The, you know, which again, back to McCartney, when he makes good records, it's because like Nigel Godrich is there and he'll be like, he's the only one that says no to Sir Paul.
Yeah. Because
Paul, you know, here's this song. And he's like, I don't like that song. You're like, what do you mean you don't like it? I'm paying you. I'm Sir Paul. I don't like it. It's a crappy song. I'm not doing it. You know?
Yeah.
Who's going to say no to him? You know, everybody, yes, yeah. okay, let's record it. So they're not like that. But it's nice because, dude, I mean, I'm telling you, it's nice that you have that relationship with him, because if you don't, and you live in this vacuum where, like, anything you write down or anything you record, if you're your only point of reference, it's like this feedback loop.
Yeah, and you get caught in
right.
And I think, I mean, there we can also talk about, if we want to think historical references, I mean, people who made really terrible records or who are at maybe a place in their lives creatively within the industry where nobody says no anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And then, I mean, the example I think of is Lulu. You know, because Chuck Klosterman wrote this really great Lulu. Piece for Grantland, where he said about how,
did
you know,
did that end up being his last record?
Yes.
Oh, Jesus Christ Almighty.
I know. Isn't that terrifying,
what?
Awful, and fitting? But he wrote this great piece where he said, you know, you think about it, Lulu was the product of an era when recorded music had no monetary value.
Yeah.
Because if yeah. anybody gave a crap and could mm-hmm. make $100 million on a Metallica record,
mm-hmm.
and they went to the record company and said, hey, listen, we're going to make this thing, and it's going to be with the Lou Reed, and it's going to be unlistenable, and that will be great. They would say, yeah, that's great. Bob Rock is in Miami right now. You should probably go write Enter Sandman 2 on the yeah. plane.
Not only that,
there.
But you're contractually obligated to
write
so.
Enter Sandman.
Right, because we
and
own
he said that
you
in
do.
Some yeah. cases, he's like, you know, the indie thing. And it made me question a lot of things. He was like, well, the indie thing was supposed to, like, liberate the artist from corporate control. And there's
did.
A lot of shitty corporate rock out there.
Yeah.
But then he said, actually, for maybe some people, they do right. need an industry to say, yeah, no, you're not going to be creative. You are going to do what you're supposed to do.
Right. So Paul had John Lennon. Yeah. They should have had the monetary value system, but
yeah.
they didn't. So everyone needs their El Guapo. to quote the Three Amigos, everyone needs the metaphorical large Mexican angry man trying to kill them.
Yes. We all need that.
Our El Guapo, yeah.
Now, I want to say, though, there's another dimension to this.
Yeah.
What if El Guapo is internal and too powerful? Because the other thing, if you're around creative people and they let you in, there's lots and lots and lots of people out there who are unbelievably talented who think their work is shit. And
back to Confederacy of Dunces.
Right. There's that problem too. And so it still is this interminate. Now, how do you know something's done? Now, I know with you, with the way you guys record, you use Pro Tools, you make a track, or you make things, and then don't you just replace it? Doesn't it evolve from the demo?
Yeah.
Which so leads to this question of how do you know when it's done?
Right. Well, we are lucky because being having music, we have this kind of backbone that not every medium has, I guess. Maybe there's a some sort of analogy to, in every medium, but we have tempo. And tempo is the great equalizer and the dictator of all, everything. So you're right, we can start replacing things, assuming that the way we got it right feels right. It's the right speed, it's the right tempo, it's the right energy, right? You do that, you can start going, all right, well, let's just tweak this here and replace this. And hey, sometimes we even keep stuff. Sometimes we will nail a take and we just go, I like the way that sounds, and we'll just use it. I mean, there's a couple tracks on Forcing a Smile that we ended up using the demo, like the demo vocal. But to do that, we had to have the right rhythm to begin with. So yeah, but other than that, you're right. At what point do you go, this is done? So for us, in general, the way we've solved that is we basically start it, and this is what we've done with our new record that we're working on. You saw the last show we played, although we had a technical malfunction and didn't play one of the songs. But the idea is we want to play it live first, and we really try not to record too much or if anything, that we can't play live. The reason, the idea being, as I said, it's almost like the way that we can limit ourselves in order to focus our energy. Because otherwise, if you just stick to what you can play live, there's your wall of like, don't go any further. Don't go down this abyss of like, well, now let's make it 95 tracks and put on this extra, you know, Glockenspiel part because we can't do it live, right? Yeah. So that's kind of our way of being like, it's too far. Can you play it live? Then shut up. Like, then go back home. You're drunk, you know, like that kind of thing. We have been cheating, though, because a lot of the new stuff, some of the new stuff I've been demoing out on my own before it even gets to those guys, I'm layering things like percussion, which I can't, Woody and I don't have enough physical hands to do it live. So we have been recording, and then he's been using like drum pads to sample them. Now, he does it in real time. In other words, they're not pre.
Yeah.
They're not. They don't just.
It's not like a
out.
DAT tape there. You just go, oh, we're going to play this part and we'll play along to the machine.
Exactly. He's actually triggering the sounds with his. You know, so it still takes coordination, but it's actually specifically like tambourine and, you know, hand claps and not too many instruments, but it's like, because I can't do that and he can't do it. So we're kind
of. You only have four hands between the two.
Right, exactly. So we're kind of.
If you had six, if you had.
And we both use our feet too, actually, because I got my pedals and he has his. So, yeah, four hands. And so, that we're kind of cheating. We're kind of pressing the envelope of that wall that we made for ourselves of like, we'll never go any further. So maybe. And maybe for you, I won't speak for yourself, but maybe. I mean, do you have a kind of wall? Something that you built in for yourself in your structure that you can say, well, you know what? I really don't want to go any further than blah, blah, blah.
I think it's boredom. Which is so unhealthy. It's boredom. It's like, well, this...
But doesn't that move... Isn't that subjective? Doesn't that move around? Or do you have a certain... Like, is there a finite point when you become...
You know, like, is it a timeline? This is the reason why I'm not a published poet. That's why, this is why when I get ahead of my head above water and I'm going to get a manuscript together, one of the things is, well, what can I go back to? What are the things I can go back to? Oh, that's still pretty good.
Well, explain what you mean. What do you mean come back to?
I mean, stuff that I wrote years ago. And I mean, that's my thought of how I'm going to put my manuscript together is I'm just going to take a look at everything. And sort of play process of elimination. Or say like...
So do you have a good filter on your own stuff from later, do you think?
From the more recent stuff? No. I write it till it gets bored. I get bored.
Bored of reading it or bored of writing it?
Both.
Okay.
When I'm just like... Because, I mean, so my process is I'll have an idea. Now, I did have the weird poem, probably the last thing I showed you, that I woke up with. I woke up in the morning.
And I love it.
With a complete poem. And it's like, part of me really almost doesn't want to fuck with that, because it almost like it was so external from me that there's like one or two words. Again,
I think that's fair.
Again, Mike saying,
it's fully formed.
Hey, have you thought about this word or that word? And I'm like, oh, yeah, actually, those two words. Okay. And Mike says it's cool. It's cool.
Right.
You know, but for the most part, like, so what I'll do is I will get something out in a linear way. You know, I'll first line to last line, whatever. And then I'll immediately go back to that first line and read it and read it and read it. Oh, wait, I don't like that. And then I'll go back and I'll start at the beginning and read it, read it, read it, read it, read it. Oh, well, you know, I maybe had that right the first time. And I'll go back and I'll read it, read it, read it, read it, read it. And then at some point, I get to the point where, okay, I've looked at this on screen enough. I will print it out.
Is this just the poetry?
Yeah.
Because poetry is kind of distilled. So you have to read it.
I have to read it and have to be careful with it and have to be...
Like fiction of 5,000 pages where
fiction
like,
or my academic writing. I mean, my academic writing, I mean, it's a similar process, but it's a lot less meticulous. And I feel in a weird way with that stuff, I'm in way more control from the beginning. You know, and so I have
you're more confident?
I'm more confident. I think that target is maybe a little clearer. Maybe I have a little better sense of the audience that I'm writing for and what their expectations are.
And you can quote other people's shit.
And I can quote other people's shit. Yeah, I can just 4-page block quotes and call it a conference paper.
And notes, yeah.
As long as it's cited, folks.
Right.
And besides, also, you think I'm working in a genre where, let's face it, there's a lot of really important published scholarship out there that is utterly fucking unreadable.
Sure.
It's super important, but it's, you know, so poetry is a different thing. So I will print it out, and I will immediately, after I print out a poem, first read through, oh my God, bop, 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 bop. There's like three things that I won't notice on the screen.
Do you read it out loud?
Sometimes. Sometimes.
For like rhythm?
Sometimes. Sometimes. Rarely, I would say. And so I'll do that, and then I'll fix it, and I'll print it out again, and I'll find something else wrong, and I'll print it out maybe one more time. And then that's when
You've
I let it sit.
You've not gone green.
I've not gone green. I have a recycling bin right here next to my desk.
With this, like, bizarre wire hanging out.
Yes. Oh, no, that's not recycling. That's just me being sloppy, yeah.
Okay.
But yeah, so or I'll recycle, and I do recycle these pieces, but then I'll have a version that'll maybe have one more correction on it, and I'll walk that around. I'll sometimes carry that with me or something, or that's the one I show people.
Have you ever tried to do like, you know, I don't know, what's Burroughs, where you like just chop up the lines and throw them in the air or anything like
that? I thought
about
that. Well, you know, when it comes to creative prose... I turned that part of my brain off, or it got turned off sometime in grad school, and I don't have any interest in starting it again. I mean, I used to write fiction, and I thought about that. It's like, yeah, what if I just, you know, did cut pieces or whatever? Mm-hmm. And I was like, no, that means I'd have to learn to write fiction again.
Right. So laziness and boredom is still
your
driving factor.
Still my driving factors, yes.
Well, you know, I know we don't have to get too off topic here, but... an author that I like that I know mutual acquaintance of ours really hates, and you may hate as well, Philip Roth. regardless of his merit, you know, the guy's written a ton of books, right? And one of the things that he did is like, and you folks can look this up too, because I won't be misquoting here, but his first, something like 10 novels, there was the first sentence of every one came from this piece of paper he found at a diner. So he was some... he was some, like, TA or something, and he was grading papers, and someone... I forget the story, but someone had left behind this sheet of paper that had, like, you know, 10 or 15 sentences on it. They seemed to be unrelated to each other. Like, when he first saw the glass slipper, she was wearing it, and her hair was wet, or whatever. And then another sentence. And so he decided... The first line of, each one of these lines is going to be the first line to one of my novels. And so for the first 10 or 15, however many lines, and sometimes it dictated the novel because in a couple of them, there was people's names in them.
Yeah.
You know, Sandy looked to her left, looked to her right, and jumped off the bridge. And like he had to, so he purposefully made that rule. And it had to be the first line, and he had to use it verbatim. And so, I don't know if that was helpful to him. And then he actually ended up writing more novels than there were lines. He ran out of lines. But I always fascinated with that idea of, like, self-limitation. You know,
yeah.
From now on, I'm the guy that does this, you know?
Yes.
Because then it lets one part of your brain sleep, and the next part can kick into full. Because you're like, well, I don't have to worry about this novel has to have someone named Sandy in it, or whatever. Yeah. I mean, that's a silly example, but you're purposefully shutting off one part of your brain to, like, you know, focus on the rest of it, you know? Okay, so I know there's Sandy, and I know she jumps off a bridge. So that's like half of the book, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Now I just have to spend the rest of the time working on who Sandy is and why she's jumping off the bridge.
Yeah.
Whatever. So I thought that was interesting, you know?
Yeah, which I think is also maybe part of the existential quality of Demoitis.
Mm.
Because you think about, you're chasing a moving target. What might ultimately be a moving, invisible target, even.
Mm-hmm.
And this idea of having infinite choice. I mean, there's that great Paul Westerberg line, you know, I hate music, there's too many notes.
Right.
You know, and I'll say that in the classroom, I hate English, there's too many words.
Right.
And there's too many possible combinations of the words. And, like, you know, I mean, you could go crazy. I mean, and I think maybe some folks do. Yeah.
Go crazy.
You know, with the infinite choice. So I was thinking, like, what if, you know, you provided me with some demos of some Trigger stuff.
Yes.
And if we could listen to, and what we'll do is we'll play on the podcast a clip of a song, and we'll talk about sort of what you were thinking at the clip, you know, or of the demo version, and then play the final, and you can maybe walk us through the sort of creative process, how you got from, okay, so this one has this, but then we realized that needed to sound like this, and then we'll play the final. We'll play the complete final song.
Okay, so the setup then. This one is a song that eventually became Snake Oil, the name of it, which is on the last Triggers EP. This is just me on my piano, which is in my bedroom, and then I have an old drum kit that I bought at off Craigslist that I put in the basement, and I just put like a 4-track. Cassette recorder, so I think it's me, the piano, the drum take, and I maybe like a tambourine. I think those I think are the four. I'll have to listen. I haven't heard it in a while, but I think those are the 4 tracks. Yeah, so we'll listen to that.
So that was...
Yeah, that was the one and only demo of what became Snake Oil. I haven't heard it in a while. We just dug it out for this. The stuff that I hear is all musical. So, I mean, I'll talk about that for a little minute. But then maybe you could provide some context. I think it's just what we're talking about, right? I'm not good at... Maybe no one, but I certainly am not good with my own stuff at figuring out any sort of context. I can only really attack the music stuff and then, like, just send it out into the ether. And then hopefully it hits in certain spots that I don't even know about, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So that might be something you could... I don't know. It's hard for me. So the things I've noticed in it... So the lyrics are almost remain unchanged.
Yeah.
Which I think goes back to what I was talking about before. I really like to write stuff quickly. I think there's a couple words here and there I changed to tweak, but I mean literally like 2 or 3 words. I think most of it, at the time felt right, and it sat right in the song, and it was what I was trying to say. And I think I made a point to not overthink it, or try not to. So maybe if it hits as being, you know, rough around the edges, that as far as lyrically, that's probably why, because I was like, you know, I'm trying to put myself in my own headspace, but I'm pretty sure with those kinds of things, I'm like, it came out right, it's fine, I like it, move on, you know, because it's like, otherwise, like I said, you're sitting there picking apart, well, what did you do, is future the right word here, or it should be suture, and it's like, ah. So, for this one, for non-music folks, sorry, but 6/8 Time, which has that, like, that jaunty, like that kind of thing, which has this like bumping little feel, and then you've got that riff, you know, spoony kind of dun 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 dun. Those elements remain pretty much the same through both the which we'll play here in a minute, the final recording and that. And the lyrics and the melody. So those all are surprisingly remained intact, I thought, because I hadn't heard it in a while. The order that stuff happens is different. To me, the main things that have changed musically are, you know, obviously there's no guitar or bass in here, and when you have guitar and bass players like I do, they're just so sick. They annihilate this song in the best way possible. Like, Adam plays this song with a screwdriver. He goes, he literally, like, hits the, and he makes it, it sounds, the closest I can come to is the texture to me sounds like Electioneering or something off of, where it's kind of nasty and echoey and, like, it's a mess on purpose, you know? Yeah. But then Joe's bass is so tight, because he's, you know, matching with that kick drum. And, of course, Woody is just a total beast. And then the other thing that's missing, again, sorry for the non-musical folks, is it's in 6/8 Time, and in the final version, there's a spot where the drums kick out, and then the piano and the rest of the song remains in 6/8, but the drums kick into 4/4 Time. Boom, ba, ba, boom, boom, ba. 1, 2, 3, 4, and then kick back into 6/8 while the piano's dugga, 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 dugga. That's not in there at all.
Yeah.
So I don't know. That was probably Woody's idea. I actually don't remember. But it wasn't there, whatever it was. You know, which is a weird thing. You usually don't have two, unless you're playing some prog rock song, you don't usually have like two overlapping time signatures.
Yeah.
Again, Letdown off of OK Computer has it. So maybe OK Computer was kind of in my brain here at the moment. Yeah. I don't know. But so it's got the 4/4 overlapped. But then the rest of the stuff, that Beck, like, do, 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 na, 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 na. That was pretty much the same.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Did it have the same feel to you, or was it, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it does. I mean, obviously, you know, we'll play the final version in a second here, but
I'll probably have more to say about that, but yeah.
Yeah. I think for me, it has a vibe to it. And I guess the problem that I have now, because in another way that Demoitis came into my life, is you played me Trigger's demos. It was like, listen, there's a thing called Demoitis. This isn't the final song, so don't fall in love with it. And there are things that I've heard. That was a good impression of me. Yes.
Thank you very much.
Yes. That are, you know, that sound to me like they're done songs. Like, that to me didn't sound done. You know, because maybe just how it was recorded. And it was
but you didn't hear that first, though.
I didn't hear that first.
So, see, that's, I guess that doesn't
that's
answer our
part
question.
Part of it, though, is that what there's if you'd heard things that I've first? Heard.
Could you have heard, putting me aside and the quality of the song aside, could you have a whole record that's like piano, drums, vocal, and like tambourine? Like, would that be a whole record? Or is it, in other words, is it not done because there's just not enough instruments on it? Or it just doesn't sound done because...
That's the guys I've heard the final version.
Ah.
And the vocal mix would have been better.
The reverse.
If it was better, it would have been better, you know.
We should have a contest. People write in, what should we call the reverse Demoitis?
Larry Kingism. You know, because that's the thing. Larry King, he likes every movie he's ever seen.
You just answered your own contest.
Yes. Sorry. I win. I keep the puppy. Yeah, Larry King, he always said, if you ever see a movie poster with a Larry King quote, run.
Yeah.
Because basically, and he'll admit this, he's like, he loves every movie he's ever seen. He's never seen a bad film. Mm. Even films other intelligent people mm-hmm. and media people who have seen other films in their lives have seen and said, wow, that sucks. Larry King will say, oh, that's great. It's a thrill ride or something. Right, and it'll be, you know, Larry non-stop King, CNN, action, yeah. nonstop action, a million laughs or right, whatever.
Right.
So that's the other side of it. And I think sometimes that's, for me, sometimes with your band, I do have Larry King-itis. Because right. I'll just say, oh, that's fucking great. You should put that out. You should just make the Guided by Voices record and just dump every demo you've ever had out, and it'll be like 48 tracks, and it'll be totally dense and unlistenable.
You have this CD I brought over now. You've got like 14 of them.
Yeah, so there we go. Now I have the Larry. Now I have it.
Well, let's play the final one, and then I'll probably have more to say, but I definitely know where my head was when we were doing this one much more than I remember the demo, you know, just because... You know, for everything that you end up recording, at least for me, you might have 7, 8... maybe it's like that with you, with your writing. Mm-hmm. Do you have a bunch of stuff that just don't make the cut, right?
Rarely.
Oh, okay. Well, we're different again, then. I do.
I think it's just I squeeze so little out. You know what I mean? There's just so little production there that...
So again, laziness is your motivating factor here.
Yes.
Okay, good.
All right, so let's play Snake Oil, the final version.
There ain't
okay, so that one does sound better.
Yeah, yeah, that sounds significantly better. Okay, so that, wow, that actually sounds really good to my ear. So that kind
of
answer...
it kind of is amazing, yeah.
Well, no, I didn't
say that.
No.
There is something special that happens when you four human beings make
well,
a song.
I think you just hit the nail on the head. I mean, you know, because we're kind of answering our own question as we go. Or at least I'll speak for myself. With these, I didn't really have like a point of view going into this, but at least in my particular example, like, it's very clear to me that those three make all the difference in the world on this song. Like, no, and I don't mean that in a pithy way. Like, obviously, okay, they all are great musicians, but just like everything that I loved about that, every single one of it was just like, oh, listen to Joe. Yeah, but oh, Adam's killing that. Oh man, that drum fit. Like, it's all like, you know, because once you lay the foundation, you're just like, you know, you let out, because really my part didn't really change that much from those two. You know what I'm saying? My meaning the keys. And
yeah.
So the keys, again, for the non-musical folks, check out here for a second. But the keys, instead of piano, that's a Wurlitzer, a Distorted Wurlitzer. And and then the bass is just, it's almost like a lead instrument at the beginning. It's, mm-hmm. Before even the guitar kicks in. And because it's a lead instrument, Adam makes a really great, like, hey, I'm gonna be a texture instrument now. So he starts going that, like, all that noise because Joe's murdering his part.
Mm-hmm.
Adam's taking that step back and letting, you know, and I'm just doing texture. I'm just going, bah, 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 bah. And then dynamically, that song sounds so much better there because, like, my vocal take is better. Like, I'm quiet and we're all soft and loud. And then we already talked about the time signature change. And then the end, I've forgotten that Adam sings that. Oh,
yeah.
You know, boom, da, boom, da, boom, boom, da, boom, all that like rhythm stuff. So yeah, musically, it's not even close for me. I mean, there's just so much. It's like, now, and I'm going to take a stab at this, and I'm not the best person to talk about this, but like, emotionally, or not, whatever you want to call it, it's darker, right? In this version.
Yes.
It's kind of like,
yeah, especially with those like sort of high vocals and the at the end is sort of it's like sort of devastating. Like, yeah, the ghostly warble at the end. Yeah, and
It is darker, right?
Yeah, it is darker,
but it's also kind of more, you know,
which I think also adds to the darkness. There's that aggression and then the high, you know.
Yeah. So I guess if you're going to put just clips of it, maybe...
Well, we'll play the whole song.
Oh, okay.
We'll do clip of the demo.
Gotcha.
And then the whole, because the world needs to hear that.
thank you. And I make a dime every time you do that.
Yes, exactly. A dime off the free download. I'll owe you another beer. But you still, I mean, so you don't have... You guys self-release, self-produce... You have your own recording space, mm-hmm. and you also have this incredibly powerful piece of software that can make 9 million mm-hmm. changes and edits and
Jay Canner, the drummer from Denora, does our mixing and mastering, and he is a creative guy in his own right. He's got his own, well, not his band, but he has a band that he records their stuff. So that's another. I mean, there's been, I don't remember in this particular case, but there's been many cases where he's come back to it. I mean, he did 18 Frames and Zane, and so there's been many cases where he'll come back to us and go, "Hey, I kind of took some liberty on this. I kind of made your vocal do this," and we go, "Oh, that's great." You know what I mean? And so there's no telling. You know, we're not really archivist people. We don't really. Adam has a little element of that. We don't. So I don't remember is my point. Like, we don't like, you know, painstakingly document. Well, this is version one.
So basically the Beach Boys Smile box set that has the entire CD of Good Vibrations, that's never happening.
And in fact, you can vouch for me, even just the idea of putting demos together to come over here. You know, I was just like, I just went through my car and found some old stuff. Like, we didn't really have like a vetting process. I was like, oh, I have this on. I found this. Like, okay, we'll play that. But I would encourage, anybody who's listening, even if like, because sometimes I think you brought up a good point. Sometimes people who, you know, you like you said, your friend there, is it, what's his name? Chris? I forget his name. The friend that who's...
Oh, the person against Fiat, Mike Bignall.
So Mike, you know, I don't know, but he takes his craft really, really seriously, and like, you know, that's what kind of what he does. But even if that's not what you do, even if that's not like what defines you, I think anything that you do of any sort of creative element, it's worth having this conversation about, right? About,
yeah.
I mean, even if at your job you have some little thing, I mean, I don't really know, but it seems to me like there's always a benefit for deciding at what point can you, do you need to own your own thing and not listen to anyone else? At what point can do you allow collaboration? And then what point do you let it go? Are you going, this is done, this is what I have to say for myself? And in this case, the things that I think were done from almost the demo was really that rhythm, the riff, you know, that and the lyric. And those three elements stayed the same. Everything else was up for grabs, as you heard, you know, and people just took elements, pieces of it, you know. And just because that ended up being Joe's bass part, I guarantee you, you know, Woody or Adam had a say in it. And then same with the drums and the guitar, you know what I mean? Yeah. So it was super collaborative.
Yeah. So I think at that moment, at that note, I think it's time for the bottom five.
Okay.
All right. Bottom five.
I've done this before, but I forget what...
Yes. The bottom five is a series of questions not related to our main topic that are of a surrealistic and or philosophical nature. All right. Are you ready?
Is it a time thing? Do I have to go quickly?
No.
Oh, I can think about it. I guess it doesn't really make
dead
for
air.
Exciting.
Okay. Dead air.
All right.
Question one. Name an item from your childhood that you lost or got rid of that you most wish you could get back.
There was a what I called my saddle ring. It was a ring that my father sent away for. I want to say cereal box, but it could have been something else. When he was little, it was there was a saddle on it. I don't know how I remember this. And I was out in the some cabin or something and skipping stones, and it just flung off of my hand and into the lake. And I came running into my dad, you know, because he the way he gave it to me was like, I sent away from this when I was your age, and, you know, very formal.
Oh.
So I was like, oh, this is like a family heirloom, you know, I really just let this man down. And, you know, obviously to his credit, although, you know, he it was totally like, oh, you know, I'm crying. Oh, don't worry about it. It's fine. I just sent away for it. So I think I can't remember now if what attaches me to it is the initial memory of him giving it to me or how he handled me losing it. You know, I can't, because either way, it's a testament to what a great dude he is. You know, so definitely
awesome. Question two: what's the strangest item you have eaten and or found in your stool?
I'm going to go option A, because I've never gone through...
Well, you never like just, oh, there's a Lego in there?
Nope.
No, okay, that's good.
I don't even look, I just pretend it doesn't exist.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I can't even believe I'm talking about it.
Yeah.
It's a big step for me. Step stool.
Everybody poops.
Yeah, no. The strangest thing I've ever eaten, goodness gracious, I think... There was a period when I was living with the old drummer from Monarch where, you know, we were dirt poor. And somehow we used to eat, both of us used to eat Dinty Moore beef stew.
Oh!
Which, I don't know if anyone's familiar with this. You used to, like, get a baked potato. Because, you know, potatoes and Dinty Moore are, like, dirt cheap.
Yeah.
This must have been his idea. I never would have come up with this. And you, like, bake this potato... Or in his case, nuke it, which is, like, even worse. It's, like, you know, because it's... Just, and then you just empty this, like... I mean, I think it's just microwave, right? You just...
Mm-hmm.
And then the,
well, you
the,
can microwave,
the second runner-up is I had this roommate who I came home and found him eating... and I didn't eat this myself, but he was eating, like, a red jelly paste. And I asked him what was up, and he was like, I don't know. Like, I just went and heated the soup up, and it's so gross. And I was like... It was Campbell's soup, and I said, "Well, you added water, right?" And he's no, and so I start laughing because he just ate the condensed soup, and he got so mad at me, he stood up, and was like, "That's it, I'm moving home. My dad knows how to make soup," which is like the best thing anyone's ever yelled at me in anger. Like, he literally, my dad knows how to make soup, and I was
oh, outstanding. Lord, yeah. I had a philosophy professor would eat condensed soup.
Just
not warm either.
Just open it up.
Just open the
pre-pop top cans.
Yeah, pre-pop they sell. Wow. Or whatever. And yeah, he was.
Well, Josh, wherever you are, my man, I hope you're well. I don't know what to say. Yeah, Christ.
All right, rolling right along. Question 3. Of the living villains of history, so this has to be someone who's still alive, mm-hmm. whose obituary would you most like to write? And this question is in honor of Christopher Hitchens, where I got the idea from. Mm. Because when he got his cancer diagnosis, he was like, man, I really was hoping someday to read Henry Kissinger's and Cardinal Ratzinger's obituaries. And he says, wait, no, I wanted to write those.
Right.
And now he's like, no, I'm going to die.
Did someone write his? Like, scathing?
I'm sure it's out there. Yeah.
Okay, so I probably have, I'll give you the honest, easy answer, and then I'll think of a okay. more obscure one. The obvious easy one is Dick Cheney. I mean, that's like so on the head. I'm sure you five people that have been on your show specifically have.
I think I've won. I've had one Dick Cheney.
Because the thing about him dying is it will also represent to me like kind of an end of an era, even though it's not necessarily. Yes. But it'll be like a we can put that behind us.
yes.
Christ. Yeah. But as far as enjoying the actual. I think I will have to say. I'll have to say Hetfield, James Hetfield.
Oh, that's a good one.
Yeah. Because, Not Lars.
Okay.
First of all, his lifestyle determined his death style. I can only assume. So hopefully he'll die up completely sober and washed up and just a shriveled old empty nutsack of a human being, which is what he is currently. Oh. And then it'll just be funny to make puns like that, like I just did. So, yeah.
There you go. All right, question 4. Question 4, we're almost done. We're almost through. All right.
At least too long, I'm sorry.
Fine. We're good. Okay. We have no limits. Speaking of having no limits, right, I just figure most people can take about an hour, and we did this in parts. So who knows how long it's going to be, and who cares?
Edit it.
Fuck them. Fuck the listeners.
Fuck them.
Who gives a shit?
Yes.
It's their fault for downloading this garbage, and if they're going to listen to it, and they're going to have to go for 108 minutes or whatever, fuck them.
Yes, so, fuck it. The bum's lost, Mr. Lebowski.
Yes. Question 4. If you could unmake any invention, what would it be? If you could just time machine, granted, you have a time machine, you're always going to have time to kill Hitler.
Sure.
So, yeah, okay, so that's even on the list, whatever.
Somebody else would take care of him.
Yeah. But if you could just go and take something out of human history, some device, some technology, mm-hmm. and just be like, all right, that's gone, and I think it would be a better world without that device or that technology, what mm-hmm. would it be?
Oh, my Jesus Christ. I think I would have to say fire.
Fire?
You know, because it's the thing that supposedly separates us most from the rest of the animals, right? It's the thing that made us control the rest of the animals. Let's just, if that's our big support in this whole godforsaken mess, this is the thing. It's not our soul. Let's just kick that out. Let's eliminate that variable and let's see where we stand.
Yeah.
Do we end up like Planet of the Apes, where it's just like we're just going head to head against everybody else because we don't have fire?
Yeah.
Are we still living in?
We'd all be vegetarians.
We'd all be
vegan raw. We'd all be eating a vegan raw diet.
We'd all still live in Lawrenceville, obviously.
Yes.
We're not
Lawrenceville
that close
would
in.
Still be there.
Yeah.
And hundreds of hipsters would freeze to death.
It's just Gaucho would be way the fuck out of business right now. But I'm just saying, if you take the one thing that supposedly separates us, you know, and just, you know, kick that out and just say, all right, well, that's gone. Now what? Is there some other element of spirituality or some other, you know, or is it
well,
just...
Well, I've been thinking about the post-human question a lot, you know. I mean, there's even the thing, there's this book Franco Moretti wrote called Distant Reading, where even in the humanities, there's this thought of maybe the best interpreters of literature might be algorithms.
Hmm.
And that maybe you get close reading out, and you take the human out of the humanities, and you just dump, you full
eliminate
text
the
scan,
variable, yeah,
and then see like what kind of verb pairings there are, and does that, and what kind of adjective pairings there are, or whatever, and that's maybe the best way to interpret. And so, you know, you think if you even take the human out of the humanities, you're left with the Douglas Copeland proposition that, as special as we think we are, the only human activities that have no animal likeness is weightlifting and smoking. And that even takes smoking out of that equation.
Yeah, it does,
you know?
Actually.
So we would just be lifting weights.
Lifting weights.
We need to lift, that's what we got. Dude, do you lift,
yeah,
bro? That's what we would say to monkeys as they were bashing their heads in for the meat. Do you lift, bro? And that would be it. That's what we got. And we'd eat that monkey raw. We'd eat that monkey raw.
Now, that is dependent upon the fact that you count fire as an invention, which I'm using that loosely. I mean,
I think so. I mean, the taming
lightning strikes,
of fire,
I guess you could run around and use it, but it wouldn't happen enough that you'd
consider
would feel
like, oh shit, there's forest fire, snakes!
Exactly.
So that would be the thing. Okay. All right. And there'd be no global warming either. So.
Right.
And probably not humans.
We're just reinforcing my answer.
Yeah, here we go. Last question. Are you ready?
I think so.
This is a new question. No one has ever had this question before.
Question virgin.
It's a virgin question. All right. If everyone in the world were like you, it's a two-parter. How would the world be better? And how would it be worse?
Wow.
If everyone
We'd
was...
We'd all have big dicks, yo! That answered the question in both ways.
Oh, boy.
I honestly think that pretty much summed it up.
Yes. Well.
You're going to have to retire that question now.
Yeah, that's a one and done. That one's never coming back. Oh, boy. Well.
Thanks for having me, man.
Yeah, I think that's about it. Our next episode will eventually happen, and it will be about something. Our homepage, where you can find new and old episodes, is gunnadiepodcast.com. Though I don't actually check that website, so it might be a hardcore pornography website now when I go to upload this. Who knows? We're also on iTunes. Follow us on Twitter at gunnadiepodcast, and We're All Gonna Die is on Facebook and Google+, though I haven't probably updated that page in about a year, but you can be the third person to follow us on Google+. And thanks, Brett, as always, for the lovely theme music.
Keep an eye on Trigger's music.
Yes, triggersmusic.com. And
Facebook, and we got a show in November at Brillo.
Brillo, and what's
the record coming out?
Yeah, is there an ETA on that new record?
Next year. Next year. And I've got something I'm working on too. So
yeah, there'll be music and there'll be links and later meets.
Yeah. Someone's home.